In this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Ann Willis, a PhD student at UC Davis studying civil engineering. More specifically, how civil engineering can be used to study streams. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Ann Willis. Ann has loved water ever since she was a little girl, but it wasn't until she went on a whitewater rafting trip on the Middle Fork Salmon River in Idaho that she really discovered rivers. Ann is originally from the Northeast, so the big rivers of the West were a revelation. Rather than study any one aspect of river ecology, she wanted to understand the rivers themselves, how they moved and changed, and what qualities of the water made it good or bad for certain ecosystems. She received her master's in civil engineering from UC Davis in 2007, and is now working towards her PhD, also in civil engineering. Ann also runs her own research program at the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences. As well as trying to understand the natural dynamics of streams and their water quality, she also focuses on projects about how to reconcile how humans use streams, especially in places where the streams support valuable, high-quality cold water ecosystems. Welcome to the podcast, Ann.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So your love of rivers also led you to something you left completely out of your bio, that you are also a rafting guide. So how did you first get into guiding?
Well, that was my mother's fault. When I graduated college, my undergraduate work was in English literature and print journalism. That was in the early 2000s. And when I finished college, I just felt like I had no idea what I wanted to do and no idea where I wanted to be. And my mother gave me this 6-day rafting trip on the Middle Fork Salmon. I had never been camping. I had never been rafting. And when I went on that trip, by the end of it, I just felt like my soul had been plugged in. I had never seen anything like it. I had never felt more alive. And I wanted that feeling. And so when I thought about, well, how did I get it? Like, I guess I'm going to have to do a lot more rafting. And so at the end of the trip, I told my mother, I said, I'm going to go be a whitewater raft guide. And she was horrified because I had just finished all of this school. So I went to guide school in the spring on the recommendation from one of the guides who had been on my trip. And from there, just totally immersed myself in that community. And that was in the Sierra Nevada range in California. And so I was on the South Fork American River, which flows just east of Sacramento for a year. And then I moved a little bit further south and I was working the rivers that came out of Yosemite, the Merced River, and then the Tuolumne River. And from there, just started to explore a bunch of the other rivers around the West. I got to go to the Grand Canyon, the Rogue, and it worked really well for a while. And then I actually got into a rafting accident not that long into that part of my career and realized that things like health insurance and 401ks and savings could be really useful at some points in my life. And so that's when I started to think more seriously about, well, how can I develop a career that keeps me connected with rivers and keeps me connected with the places I love and that make me feel so good to be part of them, but in a little bit more sustainable way. And so that's when I made the transition from rafting guide to engineer.
And so you headed to UC Davis to study civil engineering, but your rafting days weren't done. You did get to help guide some other students from UC Davis down the Grand Canyon. What was that experience like?
It was wonderful. And I have to say that opportunity that UC Davis makes available to students was one of the big reasons why I chose to go to school here, because I mean, I don't know that everybody would share my experience, but I did feel when I was younger that I was just kind of like science stupid. Like I couldn't do it. I couldn't learn it. I couldn't understand it. But when I started rafting, all of a sudden, everything had context in a way that made things that seemed so impossible to understand much clearer. And so I learned a lot about how I learn and what makes sense to me. And so when I was looking at different programs, I wasn't really concerned with things like rankings or, well, you know, any of those kind of statistics that I think a lot of schools use to promote their programs. What I was really looking for was what program teaches in a way that would connect with me and that where I'll really be able to meet my fullest potential, make my biggest contribution to the world. And so when I looked at the work that was being done in Davis, there were a lot of things that really stood out to me. One of them was I had happened to come across, there's a woman, her name is Sarah Null. She's a professor out at Utah State now, but at the time she was a master's student at UC Davis. And her project was looking at what would happen if we just removed Hetch Hetchy. And so for the listeners who don't know, Hetch Hetchy is the big water project that blocks the Tuolumne River in Yosemite National Park and then is the drinking water source for San Francisco. And so there's been a lot of controversy around whether or not that should ever have happened, because the Hetch Hetchy Valley is one that, I think it was John Muir said, even outshone Yosemite for its beauty. And so I had always thought, like, well, I would like to understand how you make a decision about a problem like that. Like, how do you decide which dam should come down, which one should stay up, like which water is worth using, which water is worth leaving alone. And that's what her project was. And when I saw that and all the different ways she was looking at it, not just in terms of like dollars, but also what does this mean for conservation? How long would the recovery look like? What would this mean for water supply and people? You know, looking at it in such a multifaceted way really made a lot of sense to me. And I was like, that's the kind of work I want to do. And so then when I did a little bit more exploring about how UC Davis teaches its students, one of the things it has is this class whose name is a mouthful. It's called Ecogeomorphology. But what it is professors who come together from departments all over campus, and then they teach this one interdisciplinary class where no matter what field you come from, you're going to learn a little bit about all the fields that might touch water science. And so there's fisheries ecologists and like bug ecologists and economists and engineers and hydrologists and geomorphologists. And at the end of that class, once you've learned a little bit about everybody's science and how it all connects to the other parts, then you go out on this expedition trip. And so my trip when I was a student was on the Grand Ronde in northeastern Oregon. And you go out and you collect data. And for a lot of us, it was the first time we'd ever like collected data or taken a sample or understood like how you get from, you know, just looking at a river to getting actual numbers where you can then describe the different parts of it and then go back to, you know, a lab or your computer and then try and make sense about how that river is working. So I went as a student, and then after that, because I just so deeply believed in that kind of approach to teaching, and because of my background as a guide, I asked if I could continue to participate as a guide, and they said yes. Thankfully, I'm so grateful. And so since then, we used to go to different rivers every year, and now we've kind of really focused on learning one place really well, and that's been the Grand Canyon. So for, I think, 4 years now, I've been a guide on the class trip, and so a guide / instructor, bringing my expertise and what I know about how streams work, but also my river knowledge and bringing students down. And I'm going again next spring too, so I'm really looking forward to it.
As we mentioned, you headed back to UC Davis, and your degrees are in civil engineering, and to me that sparks images of roads and bridges, and I was wondering how does one interested in rivers get into civil engineering, but I think you somewhat answered it in the last answer when you talked about choosing what dam to remove to restore rivers.
You know, that, so another place I really struggled when I wanted to go back to school was with exactly the thing that you just identified. I didn't really know how to talk about what it was I was interested in, and I didn't really know what fields focused on those things. And so I think that one of the biggest barriers to me understanding what it is I really wanted to do is just vocabulary. And so one of the things I did was I would take classes through community college. So I did a lot of my math and science, my basic math and science at Butte Community College, which was a great way to even see if I could handle this kind of field. But then from there, I would make connections with other students who were going to other schools and then other teachers at those schools. And so it was really in having lots and lots and lots of conversations with lots and lots and lots of different people that I came to understand that engineering wasn't just roads and bridges and structures, but could also be the science of a physical system and how it worked together. And that was really interesting to me because I had assumed that that was just hydrology. But one of my first jobs in this field was as an intern at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I was working for a man whose background was actually in U.S. history, but now is chief of water management for the Sacramento District. And so his master's had been in hydrology, and I talked to him and I said, you know, this is kind of what I'm interested in. I'm interested in rivers. I'm interested in how they work. I'm interested in how the pieces fit together. What is that? Like, what can you help me put a name on what it is that I'm interested in? And he said, you know, you should really talk to Jay Lund at UC Davis. And Jay Lund is an environmental engineer at UC Davis. And I had the same reaction. I was like, huh, engineering, that doesn't really seem like what it is I'm interested in, but okay. So I came and I talked to Jay, and he showed me the different kinds of classes I would take if that was a field I wanted to be a part of. And what I loved about it was it was hydrology and it was water quality and it was a little bit of geology and learning about ecology. But the other aspect to it that really kind of sealed the deal for me and made me choose engineering over one of those other specialties was it included a lot of policy as well. And I felt like that was really the kind of scientist I wanted to be, was one who brought information to bear on big decisions. And so being able to incorporate that policy aspect into my education was what made engineering so attractive to me. But, you know, even today when people ask me what I do and I say I'm an engineer, their assumptions are the same as mine were. And it takes a lot of explaining, and I think it's almost a shame. Well, it is a shame because it's such a wonderful field. It's so interesting. There are great people in it, and kind of with outside of our field, nobody really knows we exist. And I hope they do because it's been such a wonderful experience for me to be a part of.
How exactly does studying civil engineering, you know, all the different disciplines you study within that, help you learn more about the rivers that you are so fascinated with?
The engineers who I work with, we all share this common feature where we want to understand a system, you know, and I think sometimes we're criticized for it rightly, that we want to oversimplify things that are very complicated. But at the same time, when I look at what engineers can do, whether it's through building a computer model of how water moves through a stream or a computer model about how heat moves through a stream and then understanding what that means for the temperature of the water as it flows downstream, we're able to, by understanding all those pieces, then also understand what exactly is the potential for a stream to be restored or be conserved if it's a place where people are really interested in recovering some sort of ecosystem function. And if there is potential for improvements in that way, we also then get a sense through the work we do of what knobs we can turn to make that happen. And is it a knob that you really have to force and isn't kind of a natural part of the way that system works? Or is it more just kind of like a gentle nudge to get it going back in the direction it really wants to work? And in that way, to me, I feel like what I do is almost, I look at conservation projects and I try and understand, like, where can we make a difference? Where is it easy? Where is it hard? Where is it going to work? Where is it not going to work? And then, you know, what does that mean for the natural world? Like, do we understand something different about it? Is there something new about the way it works that maybe we didn't see before? And how can we take that knowledge to then rethink everything else we're doing to manage streams and conserve them?
You study a lot of these conservation projects, and kind of sounds like you work more in restoring streams. But if you were given a blank slate and able to build the perfect river, what would it be like?
Oh, boy. Well, I have to say, I think the Middle Fork salmon comes about as close as you possibly could get to perfect. And there are a lot of things I love about it. I love trees. I'm from the Northeast, and so trees are just really appealing to me. I find the desert dusty. And so, you know, the geography of where it is, it's beautiful. It's remote. The whitewater enthusiast in me really loves the challenge of the rapids. But the other thing I love about it is that you see so much of nature happening right along with you, whether it's fish moving up into the river or bears coming down or, you know, just healthy grasslands, healthy ecosystems. I mean, something I feel like when we are able to have a place like that and allow it to keep sustaining itself, and I won't say unmanaged, because I think these days even the wild is managed. You know, we protect it. We put a border around it. We put it in a preserve. We put it in a national park. You know, there's something we're always doing to manage any kind of land, whether it's land where people are living or not. But places like that seem to work so well with, that's really the perfect river to me. I think of those places as really kind of unspoiled landscapes, but I'm so happy that that doesn't mean we can't be there too. And I think that's really what drives the kind of research I'm interested in doing and the projects I take on, is I'm so aware of how meaningful that experience was for me, like being out on a river and being able to engage with it and being part of it, that when I think about what conservation means for people in the future, I don't like the idea of kind of reserve and preserve lands that nobody can ever access, because I think without being able to access it, it doesn't really become a part of, you know, kind of the fabric of your soul and identity. And if it's not there, then it's also really hard to get people to value it in the long term. And so that's really the perfect river to me, something that's unspoiled, but that I can still have a place for myself into.
Most of the rivers and streams that we experience or drive over every day are far from perfect, far from the perfect image that you just painted of the Middle Fork of the Salmon River. And so you do a lot of work focusing on how to reconcile how humans use those streams. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those projects? Are they dam removals or just simply land use changes? Or what can you tell us about those?
Well, here's where I'll tap into my closet ecologist identity and say, it depends. When I come to a project, one of the first things I ask myself is, what are we trying to do here? Like, what is the objective? And a lot of the places where I work in the Lower Klamath, the objective is to create streams that can then support a particular kind of salmon, coho salmon. And in California, it's listed as threatened under the California Endangered Species Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act too. And so I look at a stream and I say, okay, you know, what does a coho need? Well, I'm an engineer, so I don't typically know the answers to questions like that. But because of where I work at the Center for Watershed Sciences, I have a collaborator who is a fish ecologist. And I ask him, I say, Rob, you know, tell me what it is that I'm trying to create here. What would work for a salmon? And he will tell me. And then I'll look and I'll look at the different features of the stream. I'll say, okay, well, where does the water come from? Is it coming from snowmelt? Is it coming from rainfall runoff? Is it coming from springs coming out of the ground? Because where it comes from tells me a lot about when there'll be a lot of water in the stream, where the water will be in the stream, the quality of water that will be in the stream, and kind of the pattern of the whole cycle for both the quantity and quality of water as you go through, you know, the life cycle of a stream. And so I'll look at all of those components and I'll say, yeah, this would be a good candidate to try and do some sort of project to, you know, make some good habitat for coho. And then I'll look and I'll say, well, if we don't have that right now, why don't we have that? Is it because there's a lot of cattle grazing in the area and the stream isn't fenced, and so the banks are in bad shape, so there's no riparian canopy, so there's no cover and there's nothing to shade the stream? Or is it because there's a really big diversion and it takes out a lot of water and we really need to understand, can we re-engineer this diversion maybe to leave more water in stream or just not divert as much? or what other problems have we faced? I mean, I find those are really some of the really, those are kind of the two most common problems I encounter in the projects I come in, is it's usually there's too little water in the stream, or something has happened that's kind of disrupted the cycle of what keeps the water in good quality for fish. So one project I worked on is called the Big Springs Creek Project, and that was a really special project. It was my first one out of grad school that I did as a, you know, as a professional. I was a consultant at the time. And the Nature Conservancy had bought this ranch in Northern California, far north, even north of Mount Shasta, almost to the Oregon border. And the stream looked awful. It was wide. It was shallow. It flowed through what was at the time privately held property that was an active cattle ranch. So cows were grazing in stream all the time. But the other thing that made it really special was that all of the water from the stream came from groundwater springs. None of the water from the stream came from rain that was running off the hills or snowmelt coming down the mountain. The only snow that ever reached the stream was at the top of Mount Shasta, and it would percolate into the ground, which has a lot of holes in it because Mount Shasta is a volcano. And so all of the, you know, the rocks underlying that volcano are really porous. So the snow would melt and it would percolate into the ground. And somewhere between 25 and 50 years later, it would emerge out of these spring sources at the head of Big Springs Creek. And because it had taken all that time to travel through all of those rocks, it had also picked up all of these really amazing nutrients that would drive a food web that would then support a really healthy fisheries. But for some reason, even though it was coming out of the ground and water that comes out of the ground stays cool and it's very reliably cool, it was getting really hot. I mean, it was going from 10 degrees centigrade at its source to 25, almost 30 degrees sometimes, 2 miles downstream. That's a rate of heating that's really extreme. And it wasn't a small amount of water, which would be understandable because, you know, small volumes of water heat up faster. No, this, we were talking about maybe 80 to 100 cubic feet per second of water. So we couldn't understand what was happening. But we looked at it and we said, well, we think if you can fence this stream, you don't have to eliminate cattle grazing on the ranch because there wasn't a lot of runoff coming off of the fields that were polluting the stream. It just seemed like something was wrong either in the stream channel itself or in the riparian corridor, the banks next to the stream, that was preventing it from staying cold. We said, we think if we fence this stream and just give us a year to watch how this system starts to reset itself, we'll give you an idea of how you can keep the stream cool. And the Nature Conservancy was really generous. They let us do that. And after a year, you know, we thought maybe we might see a lot of the riparian trees that the Nature Conservancy had planted. We might see them really establish themselves, but they actually weren't doing well at all. There had been a lot of them had died. And so we thought, okay, well, you know, one of the things that's unique about a spring-fed stream is the flows don't really go up and down and up and down season to season. They stay really stable, and those stable flows were not good for tree survival, at least the ones the Nature Conservancy had planted. Those kinds of trees really wanted these big seasonal floods and droughts and floods and droughts to do what they needed to do to survive. So the trees were dying, but one thing we noticed was that there were all of these plants in the stream itself. I mean, if you had come to this stream in August, you would never have seen the water surface. You might have thought you had just come to some other kind of field because the plants growing in the stream themselves were so dense that once they grew through the surface of the water, they created this huge canopy that covered the entire stream. And we looked at that, we said, that's unusual. That's not something that we typically see in these streams. You know, what else might be happening that looks unusual? And so we had been collecting temperature data. And when we looked at the temperature data, something that jumped out at us was the pattern of temperature in the stream was different from what we would expect a river in Northern California to look like, what you would expect temperature to do. You know, it would be cool in the winter. It would start warming up through the spring, and then sometime around late July, August, you would see it peak, and then as you moved into September and back into the fall, the temperatures would cool down again. But that's not what was happening in Big Springs Creek. What was happening was the temperature was warming through the spring, And then sometime around the middle to late June, it was peaking and then cooling. And we thought, well, that makes no sense. How could that be happening? Because summers in Northern California are hot. You know, where Big Springs Creek is, it's hot, it's dry, it's a Mediterranean climate. There's no rain through the summer. And then when we looked at what was happening with the plants, we said, well, what are these plants doing? Well, they're doing a couple things. Because the plants were growing in the river channel itself, they were taking up space in the channel that the water used to be able to flow through. And so if you think about a glass of water, you know, it has one level when you just have the water in it. But if you put ice cubes in it, the water gets deeper. You haven't put more water in the glass, but you've taken up the space in the glass with the ice cubes. And so, you know, the water gets displaced and it gets deeper. The plants were doing exactly the same thing. It was making the creek deeper, which made it harder to heat all the way through the bottom because sunlight doesn't penetrate all the way through a water column after it gets deep enough. So it was one thing the plants were doing, but the other thing they were doing, and this was something that had been totally unrecognized in the scientific community, was that they were creating what we called a riverine canopy, just this huge, dense, almost like a aquatic forest that was covering so much of the water surface of the creek that the sunlight just couldn't get to the water anymore. And so it was creating this like naturally shady, deep creek that then, because the water quality was so good, was driving a tremendous amount of like bug growth. There were really, really dense, tens of thousands of bugs in any area that we would sample. And because there were so many bugs and the water was staying cool because of the shade of the plants, all of a sudden we saw coho come back within a year. And this was remarkable because a lot of times conservation projects have a timeline that look out decades. You know, if you do a riparian planting project, if you're planting trees to cool down a stream, you're really looking out tens of years before you really expect to see something happen, because it takes a long time for a tree to grow. But these plants were plants that were recovering within the first year that the fence went up in the stream. And so the recovery was immediate. And because the recovery was immediate, we also saw fish come back immediately too. And because there was so much cover, there wasn't a lot of predation that you would expect. And also because there was so much food, there were so many bugs, the fish didn't really have to work very hard to feed. And so we have some video of just little juvenile baby salmon kind of hanging out in one spot, and you're watching bugs float through the water carried downstream by the current. And all they're doing, it's like watching a little Pac-Man figure. They're just opening their mouths and gobbling up these bugs as they float by. And eventually the fish get so fat, they develop little rolls on the back of their heads. And so by the end of the first year of restoration, when we would measure the juvenile coho in Big Springs Creek and compare it to coho in other places in the area, they were three times as big. And so we were so excited for so many reasons. We were excited because one of the things that we didn't have to do was stop ranching. And why we thought that was important was because, like many streams, and like many watersheds, 80% of the watershed we were working in was privately owned. And so if we wanted to make a difference on a big scale, we couldn't just take everybody out of production. That wasn't realistic. We had to find a way to make conservation work and keep the landscape working too, because that was the only way we were going to get buy-in from the community. And so to have the kinds of results we did and being able to keep the ranch in production at the same time, I think it's one of the biggest successes that we could have possibly had for that project.
Well, I think anyone listening to this podcast is pretty evident to them that you've definitely found your passion there at UC Davis studying rivers and how they work. But you did end up putting some of that early schooling to use, and you serve as the communications director for the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences, and you were integral in launching the center's outreach program. I guess, what led up to that? And what sort of outreach does the center partake in?
I would say the thing that led up to that was, I think there were two things really. One, I really have this belief that like what I do on my personal time can be personally satisfying, but especially as a scientist for a public university, that's a position of public service. And so I really strongly believe that, you know, as a researcher at UC Davis, it is my job to connect what I do with the public, because the public is who's paying for me. They're paying for this facility. They often are the ones paying for my grant through the big state bonds we put through. And so, you know, science can't just be a hobby for me, something that I do that's interesting. That being said, I was really insecure for a lot of reasons. I think one of them was that I wasn't a career scientist. You know, I had come through as an English major and then a journalism with a print journalism degree. And I felt like came to engineering kind of late in the game. And by the time I was getting my master's, I was going to school with people who had bachelor's degrees and always loved science, maybe even had a job or two before they had gone back to school. And so I kind of felt outmatched, like I still, like an imposter, like I didn't have a place here and I still didn't belong. And so it was really hard for me to then feel confident enough to just talk about what it is I did and what I thought and what I believed was, you know, what the science was telling me, you know, my interpretation of the science. It was hard for me to feel like that really carried any weight. But fortunately, there were a lot of other people at UC Davis who felt the same way. And there were a lot of people who were really invested in giving students and other researchers like me training in communication. And so I went to a few workshops that the campus had hosted. I think the most memorable one was a partnership they had with the Alan Alda Center for Science Communication. And it was a 3-day or 2 or 3-day workshop where we were working with people who were basically bringing the lessons of acting to us as scientists and being like, this is how you make a connection with another human being. This is how you cut through your jargon so that your passion can make the human connection that allows the other person not just to engage with you, but understand you and maybe feel like they even share something with you. And from there, then you can talk about your science. You know, but if they're not listening, if they don't feel connected to you, nothing you say will ever persuade them. And that was something that I felt like, okay, you know, maybe I'm not the best scientist in the world, but I do know how to make a human connection. And so if that's something that's going to help me succeed, like, okay, let's start there. I loved it. And I finally felt like, you know, if I was having this much success, it was something I wanted to share with my colleagues here too. They're, you know, a really wonderful group of people and I love working with them. And I said, okay, you know, we need to be better at what we do. And so the center had a few platforms that had already been developed. We had had an excellent, he was a former reporter from the Sacramento Bee and he came to be the communications director just before I took the position. And what he really gave us was, a wonderful blog, the California Water blog. And it was a place where scientists like me could come and work with him. And he would bring his professional journalism experience to the, you know, to the blog you were writing and help you, you know, kind of talk through that lens so you could engage journalists, engage policymakers by making a direct connection between science and policy. And that was really right up my alley because of my background. And then I started thinking, well, you know, if we're doing this with a blog, can we do it with video? Can we do it with audio? Can we just do it speaking as human beings to another person? How do we get better at that? And so that's when he moved on to another position, the director asked me if I would step in and I said, yes. And so the program you're referring to is called SPEAK. It's Scientists for Public Engagement and Knowledge. And it was kind of the umbrella program that we used to organize a lot of the things that we already had going at the center, but then also kind of complement it with really hands-on personal training so that people could engage in any platform in any way that they felt comfortable. So, you know, for me, I really resisted social media for a long time. I just thought it was kind of like a feral cesspool of hysteria, and I did not want any part of it. I worried about being trolled. I worried about being harassed. It was just not something I needed or wanted. But through working through some of the workshops with the social media director for campus, I really got to learn a little bit more about Twitter. I discovered science Twitter. But I think the thing that was most valuable in that training program was I made a personal connection with the social media director And with that connection, she earned my trust. And because I trusted her, I then trusted that I could look into this other platform and engage in it and maybe not be afraid in the same way that I had been before I knew her. And I thought, well, you know, again, to me, the thing that makes the biggest difference in this world is the personal connection. So I thought, well, why don't we set up a series of workshops where we work with somebody who's, you know, whose primary skill set is in video production, and then another one who's in op-ed writing and blog writing. You know, we'll work with the social media director for social media outreach. We'll do educational outreach. And so for me, it was about designing a program, not to get everybody to do the same thing, but to show people that there were so many different ways that you could engage, so many different opportunities that you could really start with the one that you felt most comfortable with, because that was what was so important, was not how you were going to be part of the public conversation, but just making the decision to be a part of the public conversation and then doing it in a way that you could feel confident and comfortable. Because that's when you can talk about your science, I think, in the best way. So we've done a series of workshops that are about communicating and outreach. But we've also done things like we've put together a bunch of exhibits that we take to schools. We call it our mobile science fair. And it's a way just to do outreach to, I think, in some ways, some of the easiest and hardest audiences you could ever have, because kids are no joke. They will just ask you any question straight out. And if you are boring them or they don't understand you, they'll walk away or tell you they don't understand. And they're not shy about it at all. So I think, you know, bringing these exhibits, we tend to bring them to schools that don't have the resources to come to us. So we go to them, and it gives our scientists a way to practice talking in a very easy kind of layperson level to a very enthusiastic but also kind of unfiltered audience. And so I think it's a great experience on both sides. And then the last thing we do is, well, for example, this weekend I'm doing this fundraising swim. I'm swimming across Lake Tahoe from Nevada to California with a team of women also from campus. We're all UC Davis, either scientists or researchers. And we're doing it to raise money for science outreach and communication training, because one of the other things we'll do besides putting on these kinds of workshops is then also send people to get trained by people who are way better at it than we are, like Alan Alda or somebody who's made a career out of making a connection with people like that. And so I would say those really are the three main ways we focus on science communication. And then, you know, as well as working with other researchers or faculty or staff on campus, we try and bring this to the students as well through those classes we were talking about earlier. So one of the ecogeomorphology classes, I went on, the theme of that class was science communication, and we invited a few reporters. We had invited Amy Quinton, who was the environmental reporter for Capital Public Radio, the NPR station in Sacramento. She came along on the trip, and I forget who the reporter was, I'm embarrassed to say, who had come along on the other half. But we wanted to connect students with a journalist and say, you know, kind of demyth some of the fears people would have about talking to a journalist, what journalists are looking for, you know, why they might be interested in your science, and but also then how to talk about your science in a way that is simple but engaging and relevant. And so we'll raise resources so that we can bring those kinds of opportunities to students as well. So those are really the big programs, the big science outreach and communication programs we have here at the center.
Well, Anne, thank you for filling us all in on all the wonderful work you're doing at UC Davis. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
A wild one. You know, I had listened to other podcasts and I heard that question. I thought, oh no, this is where I get unmasked because this is where the engineer will come out. But no, the answer is a wild one.
And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh my gosh. Wow. You know, I'll tell you exactly what it is. I share an office with two colleagues, another engineer, and I mentioned my collaborator earlier, Rob Lusardi. He's a fish ecologist, and he kind of picks up on a body of knowledge where mine ends. And we have been working together for a long time. We didn't really know each other very well before we did, but now we pretty much collaborate on every project we ever work on together. And the other day he came into the office and he just stood there and he was like, "You know what? You are my best friend." I was just so thrilled because I love working with him too. And I don't think it's easy to make friends as an adult. And so I just felt so happy that I had found a community that valued me for me. So maybe that's a surprise. I think maybe on any other day I might have picked like a Grand Canyon trip. But no, I would say on any given day, if I think about that one moment, it makes me probably happier than any other thing that's happened at work.
Well, it's clear that you really enjoy what you're doing. So the next question might be a little easy, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
Oh, well, the ones that keep me out on a river, I don't think I'd ever be very good at an office job. So I tell you places where I haven't gone where I would love to go. You know, I mentioned that the river, the project I loved in Northern California was a spring-fed system. There are spring-fed systems all over the world that I have only read papers about and would love to see someday. So New Zealand is high on my list. I think there's a few river systems in South America, Japan. Yeah, I would say moving through the Ring of Fire, that would be a dream to be able to go see some of those other places.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, I know exactly what I would work on. I would build the freshwater equivalent of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And I say this because I saw somebody post something on Twitter one day. It was about a cross-section of a redwood tree that's hanging in the Museum of Natural History in New York City. And he said, "Can you believe that people cut down this tree? Because those folks back east couldn't even imagine something this big. Like, what a travesty." And I thought about that. I said, I can totally imagine, because as a little kid, that was my favorite museum. And I would go to that exhibit every single time we went to that museum. And I would just stand there in utter awe. And I would think to myself, I am never going to see that no matter how old I get. There is no way my parents are letting me go from New York to California. But when I think about kind of the path my career has taken, I really do think that those moments, seeing things like that, was where it all started for me. And so knowing the diversity of fishes and rivers that there are in California, I would take all the money anybody would give me and I would build the same kind of facility here so that we could really showcase how incredible our landscape is.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you have programmed in everyone's head, what would it be?
Rivers change. Rivers change. I think that is the biggest lesson that I learned in my career. You know, I always thought as long as you put more water in a river, it'll be better. And it should be better everywhere, from the headwaters to the mouth. And what I've learned really, you know, kind of been ingrained in my professional upbringing is that rivers change. And some places are good and some places are bad. And so, you know, just like that kind of scenario you described earlier, people in the cars driving over a river and maybe it looks dry or maybe it looks dirty or maybe it looks hot. That might be okay, because for where that river is at that moment, that might be exactly what it's supposed to be. And so to just understand that rivers change.
Anne, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your projects there at UC Davis. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Oh, they can absolutely email me, awillis, A-W-I-L-L-I-S, at ucdavis.edu. They can also follow me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I took the plunge. So at WatershedWillis, that's my handle. Those are probably the two best ways to get in touch with me. I'm always checking them.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download, subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 48th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, rivers change.